My name is Andrea Smith. I've been involved in Indigenous women's organizing for about 20 years, particularly violence against Indigenous women. I work with Insight, Women of Color Against Violence, and the Boarding School Healing Project, and I also currently teach at the University of Michigan in Native Studies.
Thank you, Andrea. Welcome to FIRE. We were recently at the U.S. Social Forum and heard you speak about gender issues and the role of patriarchy and colonialism, and then also in terms of sexual violence. Would you look back at the U.S. Social Forum, and what do you see in terms of the participation of women? How would you assess the forum, and also in terms of Indigenous issues, particularly Indigenous women?
I think the overall issue with the U.S. Social Forum almost has nothing, it's not specifically about women or Indigenous peoples or Indigenous women. The issue is that in the World Social Forums, it's really about bringing social movements together, but in the U.S., all our work has really been co-opted by nonprofits, and we haven't really developed the social movements. So I think the U.S. Social Forum is a little early. Like, we should first develop the social movements and then have a forum to bring them all together. So I think that this agenda was a little nonprofit driven, in my opinion. And I think that's a little problem we have. We like to do these big conferences. We like to do things that look good for a foundation, but we don't actually want to do the work of grassroots organizing.
It also seems that in the U.S. there's a very provincial kind of issue-oriented where people have their different issues and then end up competing for funding.
Right. I mean, that's certainly one of the setups of the nonprofit industrial complex, where you need to meet a funder's agenda. You need to fill a certain niche, and then you be competitive with other people in your niche. You don't have an incentive to work kind of broad base, and you don't have an accountability to the base you're supposedly representing. So I think that sets it up for these kind of identity, specific identity configurations, which often don't have a broader analysis of how their issues connect with other issues.
And how can that happen? How do you see connections being made and building a movement?
Well, I think the first thing is to commit ourselves to doing kind of the hardcore grassroots organizing, and to develop independently funded movements where we are actually funded by our constituents. And I think we could maybe actually take a lesson from the Christian right, because after George Bush, when everybody got depressed and demoralized, and we forget that the Christian right actually developed in the U.S. after Barry Goldwater lost by a much greater margin than did John Kerry. But they didn't get depressed. They said they took that as their opportunity to start doing the slow organizing that nobody really saw for 40 years. But because they committed to that work, they suddenly took over the planet in the 80s, because they had committed to doing that slow grassroots base building work. And I think that's kind of what we need to do. And I think the positive side is, if you saw a lot of the workshops, like the Revolution Will Not Be Funded workshops, Another Politics Is Possible workshops, you hear that more murmuring of groups that are committing to do that work, and you're not going to see them in dazzling neon lights. They're not necessarily getting funded by funders. They've chosen not to take nonprofit status. But I think if we're patient and kind of diligent in that work, 50 years from now, we might see the fruits of this work.
And one of the efforts was with the theme of gender and sexuality as part of the forum. How would you assess that effort, given what you're talking about?
Well, I think it's important to have that included, but sometimes, again, it's done on an identity model. Let's include women. And there's not an analysis of how patriarchy structures everything, you know. So if a group has a lot of women in it, they think they don't need to address patriarchy. But patriarchy, like, infuses everything in a much deeper way than we're even consciously aware of, from everything to why we don't collectivize daycare in our organizing, or why we don't see that as part of organizing, to why we don't see an organizing strategy is to do collective cooking. You know, and our whole organizing model is really based on this career activist model, where if you're a really dedicated revolutionary, you'll be out in the streets 50 hours a week, not think of who's left behind, and nobody's taking care of people left behind. So we have a very inaccessible movement, which is another reason why we haven't really built a base. And that's one of many examples in which we can see how a lack of understanding patriarchy in a deeper way is really disenabling our movements to grow.
It also seems there's a real fear of the F word, feminism, and it's ironic given that there are now is a woman presidential candidate. What do you see in terms of how that operates in the United States, but also within the forum?
Well, I think that different communities have different interactions with the term feminist and may not like it but don't dislike it for different reasons. So I can't really speak to why white middle class women don't like it, but in the indigenous communities there's an allergy to that term because people will say it's a white thing. And I just don't agree with that for one thing, because I think actually feminism came from Native women and white women stole it from us. So I don't see why we shouldn't be claiming that term. But also, I think all terminology is strategic. Like a word opens up some conversations and it closes down other conversations. And so words that are great one day may not be good another day, and then they may be good a day after that. So rather than just having some knee-jerk reaction to any word, we should just say, what does this word do for us? And then, and what it does may change. So I remember in the 80s, there was this whole feminism as a global thing. And so I can understand why a lot of women of color, Native women, said, I'm not a feminist because I don't want to be part of your global, you know, thing that claims to be feminist but really supporting a colonial agenda. But now I think that I think it's a time to say white women don't own that term anymore. And that a lot of what gets promoted as feminism is very capitalist and colonial, and I think we should claim the term and say that they're not the feminist. And also, I think it's time that we stop apologizing for violence in our communities. I think we've had a tendency to not want to talk about it publicly because we don't want to look bad, but I think that actually comes from a colonial trap in which your claims to liberation only count if you're perfect. And if it is revealed that you have violence in your community, then we don't have to decolonize anymore. And I think we should not fall into that trap, and we should say, it doesn't matter how messed up we are, we still deserve liberation. And instead we can say, look, yes, we have these problems, but we're going to be open about it, and we can be a model for how you should openly address issues internal to your communities. So I personally see feminism as a good strategic term for now. 10 years from now, I may not think so. But I, in any case, I just don't think we should be having a high, you know, allergic reaction to any word. We should always say, what does this word do for us, and have a critical conversation over what it means, rather than say, I can't be a feminist, that's white.
So what is feminism, especially as you say that it originated within Native communities?
What I see that feminism historically coming from Native communities is because I think European American women came here and saw that Native societies were not necessarily structured on the basis of patriarchy, and patriarchy only works if it seems inevitable and natural. If you have another model that shows you don't have to live this way, people aren't going to continue to live that way. And that's why colonizers had to wipe it out, and also that's why many white women got inspiration, because they saw they didn't have to be shackled. So they were directly inspired by these models of living, but then it suddenly became their term, you know. And I just also, I hate this first, second, third wave feminist stuff, because it presumes that feminism started with white women and they control the term, and that women of color show up somehow in the third wave of feminism. But I think feminism started in 1492 in the U.S. when Native women had to resist colonization.
When you talk about within Native communities this effort to try and hide or cover up something like violence, how much of this is something that happens in a lot of movements where it's you must be loyal, and how often women were told, now, don't focus on gender, don't focus on women, because it takes away from the main revolution, etc. How much of that is just the nature of movements, and especially movements under patriarchy, and how much of it is indigenous communities?
Well, there's certainly a lot of silence in indigenous communities, to me, to an overwhelming degree that I've seen, because I've worked in that. And I remember 20 years ago, even now it's hard to talk about sexual assault, and because there's so much overwhelming shame. And I think that's just because of from boarding schools. So there's specific things that have happened historically, like boarding schools and other forms of gender violence that are so that happened at such an early age that people haven't been able to process it, and it's so painful. And working on the legacy of boarding schools is just very overwhelming. So there are some specific aspects, but it is certainly the case that organizing has developed this, to me, again, a patriarchal model of organizing where the idea is the enemy's outside and we need to be united against the enemy outside. But actually the enemy is also inside. Like, it comes with internalized hatred, internalized violence. So we tend to look at liberation on the public front, but not in the private sphere. But if we really want to liberate a community, we have to deal with both at the same time. So we have to fight the powers that be, but we also have to heal and the violence in our communities, and we have to see that as organizing work. It's not social services, it's not something you do at home. It's something that requires collective action to change, to develop a fully developed movement that's inclusive of everybody.
When you talk about the power of the boarding schools, and this morning we heard a speaker talking about historic trauma, can you explain more about that?
Well, the brief history of boarding schools was during the 1800s there became this debate as to what to do with the Indian problem. Should we kill them off physically or should we culturally assimilate them? So the issue was physical genocide or cultural genocide. Nobody was saying maybe we don't have an Indian problem. It was assumed we had one, but what should we do? And the so-called friends of the Indians said that physical genocide was messier and it was also more expensive, and it would be cheaper to culturally assimilate Native peoples. But they concluded that it's too hard to assimilate adult Native peoples. You have to assimilate them when they're kids. So one of the policies that developed was boarding schools. One thing that happened was the U.S. government transferred over the administration of Indian reservations to churches, and churches then set up on-reservation schools. Then what happened was Richard Pratt said that these on-reservation schools were not effective because it was too easy for kids to run away from home or go home during the summer and they could revert back to their pagan ways. So he started the off-reservation boarding school system where you would transport kids when they were, say, age 5, thousands of miles away, so they couldn't go back home until they were 18. So you would have people not able to speak their native languages and be punished if they did. Lots of physical, sexual, emotional violence. Also, a lot of malnutrition because the selling point of these schools is that they were cheaper way to assimilate Native peoples rather than through physical genocide. So they were run as cheaply as possible. A lot of starvation and also a lot of slavery. A lot of times children would be forced into labor for either the school or during the summers to white families to be, you know, basically work for free. So they were indentured slaves. So anyway, through this process is probably that with the Dawes Allotment Act are probably the two most devastating pieces of legislation for Native communities, where just entire generations were not parented. You know, they weren't loved, they weren't cared for, so they don't know how to parent their own children, and that's kind of where this generation of violence really starts. I mean, I've been into healing kind of workshops, and people are often asked, you know, make a family tree and say, where does alcohol first show up in your family? Where does sexual abuse show up in your family? And it's almost always the first generation that goes to boarding schools. Also, we still have boarding schools in the U.S., so abuse hasn't stopped, first of all. I should say not all boarding schools are equally bad, and some people had positive experiences, so I don't want to be too simplistic about it. But as an overall thing, it was not a positive experience for Native communities. So this is what often people call historic trauma, is things that have happened that continue to influence generation after generation. And people wonder, why is my parents so messed up? And then when you start to trace it, you realize it comes from this legacy of colonialism. So how do you start to address that? I think it can be tricky, though, because sometimes in the U.S., maybe Canada, there's a tendency to, again, make everything therapy, which is not to say it's not important, but you can make it a healing issue and take out the political context. So it's all about, in a certain way, putting a band-aid on colonialism rather than connecting the healing to organizing to actually change the conditions of colonialism.
So what are the methods used in the healing project? They're political and therapeutic?
Well, they're trying. The reason why it's probably hard to connect is also that it's not easy to do. So it's not like there's so it's easy to fall into doing one or the other because it's so hard to put them together. But that's been the intent, and it continues to be a struggle of, doing support groups, but also providing information, education, like human rights training, so that if there's not some expert who's going to run a claim with the Inter-American Court, but the communities themselves can decide if that's kind of the strategy they want to adopt, and trying to provide education for organizing. But again, sometimes we're at a point where if you do a workshop, people might travel 200 miles to get to it and then not be able to walk in the door because of the trauma boarding schools so traumatize them. So the organizing, putting the two together is just so much slower. And I think getting patient, so you try to shortcut things. So this is just a constant challenge for us, to not take those shortcuts, but it's hard. Mm-hmm.
You talked yesterday about the contradictions in terms of the state, and in this case with reparations, giving reparations to Native peoples, when it comes from a state that perpetrated that oppression, which also continues. And then you tied it in yesterday to sexual violence and how the irony is that people are looking for solutions from the state for something that the state has perpetrated on indigenous women for so long. Can you talk about those contradictions and how you would address them?
I'd say the basic contradiction we have on gender violence is that we tend to look at the state as the one that's going to protect women from violence, when the state benefits from violence against women, as I've just talked about previously. So the issue is, what kind of demands do you make? And we tend to fall in the trap of, let's get the state to arrest more abusers. Let's get them to arrest more rapists. But what are they arresting them with? They're arresting them with the apparatus of state violence, the criminal justice system, which supports the prison industrial complex and oppresses us. So then the question is, what else can we ask for? One, what if we don't assume that they're going to be the solution? Then we might figure out our own solutions. Two, that doesn't mean we may not come up with creative things, but there are things that may be less complicitous and more progressive. Like, for instance, people have talked about, what if we, instead of calling for due diligence around criminalization, what if we called for due diligence around economic, social, and cultural rights and said free housing keeps women safe? Because the majority of women in the U.S. who go back in a domestic violence situation go back because they have nowhere to live. You know, so that would kind of put things different. It wouldn't increase the criminal justice apparatus. It may have its own issues, but it may be less bad than this other kind of strategy. For reparations for the boarding schools, we thought about, instead of calling for kind of individual cash payments, learning from the situation here in Canada, we thought, well, if the U.S. gives us lots of money, they're still in charge, so are there other demands that are more challenging, like returning land bases, canceling the third world debt, and other kind of demands that would also link us to the larger global reparations movements? And these become not so much whether or not the U.S. will actually do this, but they also just become a way of radicalizing our communities and tying us to kind of a larger global movement. So I look at the legal issues as not unimportant, but to me they're a tool for political organizing. They're not the solution. They're a strategy that can help you do the organizing, because the organizing is the ultimate thing that works.
What has been the response to these ideas in terms of the organizing and the political aspect as opposed to the legal, kind of cultural, historic healing and so on?
Well, I think people see the need to kind of connect them all together, that in the end, Native peoples can't have liberation unless they're part of a larger global movement. And if there's any tool that will help us, cool, but we also always have to check out these tools and see if they're still helping us. And I think that's one of the problems with the nonprofit industrial complex, is that you get funded for specific tools and you get then invested in keeping those tools even if they don't continue to work. And you don't feel the same flexibility to drop the tools if you conclude they're no longer working, because then you won't be funded again. So by trying to be a little less invested in that, it gives us more flexibility to take tools and drop them, take it back, depending on if it really seems to be working. And then the healing, to me, is very critical. I'm not saying that, I mean, that's crucial, because we can't, if we build a movement around people who are dysfunctional, which is all of us, without addressing that dysfunctionality, then we don't have vibrant movements. But the key is to keep the healing connected to the organizing.
Thank you very much. I have one more question. When you heard that the theme of this conference is restoring the balance, what comes to mind as you've been here at this conference?
Well, I'm thinking that's what they're trying to do in a certain way, is build kind of, it's not just about organizing or working with the UN, but you can see the way they're doing the workshops is they're also trying to tend to everybody's kind of spiritual, emotional, physical well-being. I think the workshop this morning, when she was doing the medicine wheel about the mental, emotional, spiritual, physical, are all, I mean, I think those are all models that people were trying to do. And I think the catch is we just have to experiment, try new things, share what works, share what doesn't. You know, if anybody really knew the right way to end global oppression, we probably would have done it by now. So we do this with a sense of humility and a sense of humor. Keep trying new things, share, and go, you know, grow as we kind of go along.
And what is balance?
Well, I don't know what balance is. I certainly don't have it, but I think the kind of idea is kind of keeping our, I look at it as building a movement around our whole selves. and we tend to build movements around parts of ourselves. But like, if you go to movement and let's say, I don't know, your dog just died and people think you're silly, but that's really traumatizing you, and you can't tell people that your dog just died and you're not sure you really want a table today because they'll think you're dumb. So what if, you know, we had a moment where you could bring that and you could bring your pain or something even more traumatizing, obviously, and there was a place that you could get supported in healing. Or let's say you're pathologically late for everything you need to do and everybody always yells at you, but nobody ever asks, why are you always late? And is there something going on that people could support you at to make you less late? You know, so that our goal is not to be punitive and disciplinary, but is to help each other grow through whatever issues we have so that we can fully participate as full beings as much as possible.
Thank you.